that was Suki Waterhouse with OMG, and that's a fun song. Before that, Perfume Genius off his newest album, It's a Mirror. And I went to see him last time he was in town, and he's awesome. Not coming to Pittsburgh, unfortunately, on this tour, but did hit Pittsburgh last tour. And started off the set. Oh, actually, before that, Stereo Lab with Aerial Troubles, and they're just a great band. And before that, Wet Leg, Catch These Fists. And that wraps up the new and newer music show for me. Stick around for Eric with Courts in Session. And have a great week, everybody. I will be back in the fall. Bye.
Hello, I'm Dr. Ruth Westheimer. And if you listen to WRCT Pittsburgh, you know that in most cases, size does not matter.
T Pittsburgh, WRCT.org. Welcome to Ebony Spectrum. Let's take a listen to Karen Hunter and others.
There's a lady named Ellie Way. She's unmelanated. She tweeted, I don't know if Ryan Coogler intended this, though I feel that he must have on some level. Did you see this tweet?
Right before we came away.
Okay. But Sinners left me with a real sense of grief over the disconnect I feel from my cultural heritage. I'm a white American, and I have no idea where I came from. I have no cultural roots to draw from. My past is just empty.
Did you see the
somebody? Yeah, somebody said, so you ain't see the Klan in the movie? But see, you know what,
that's cold. That's cold, man.
So I felt her because yesterday I had a caller because I asked for it. I asked for somebody to call up, and he still didn't answer my question. But I'm challenging people who identify with this made-up construct of whiteness.
Right.
To do exactly what she's doing. Yeah, ask yourself why.
Yeah.
Are you Irish? Are you Italian?
It was cold that they picked her when she was down like that. That's all. Like, it's funny, but it's kind of cold. Y'all ain't had to do her. Like, y'all knew what she was trying to say.
But I'm saying, why identify with the Klan? And I'm glad that Ellie didn't identify with the Klan.
Yeah, of course.
She's like, that ain't me. Them ain't my people. I'm not identifying with that. And I'm saying, in this era where everybody's trying to remove books and stuff, well, not everybody, Trump and his people and the Daughters of Knuckle Dragon Liberty and all of the stuff, trying to remove books because it makes their children feel bad. Why do you raise your children to identify with the Klan, with the with the colonizers, with the rapists, with the genociders? Why not?
Right.
Why not tell them a different...
Yeah. My question for her is twofold. There's two points. The first point is, I actually love that Ryan Coogler didn't put the cool white people in it. I'm not saying that I like movies that do that. There's a time and place for that. I like that this wasn't about that. It wasn't like, and here's the white people on the Underground Railroad. It was like, no, that they weren't part of this story. But the second thing is, it's interesting she chose to say she couldn't relate, because the characteristics in those characters are universal characteristics. They are not black only characteristics. Bravery is a universal characteristic. A spirituality is a universal characteristic, right? Like, you don't have to, I don't know nothing about hoodoo, but I was looking at one, mean like, oh my God, you know, I feel that. That's my auntie, you know? And so you don't have to be black to understand. Even when you talk about moonshine or being a gangster, that's not a black only thing. Music is not black only, like, as evidenced by them doing that damn jig. Like, it's not. So that's stuff to identify with. You don't have to come at it from a cultural racial angle. You won't identify with it the same as a black American, but honestly, it's about damn time we had some. So let us have this one, and you can go watch any Wes Anderson film you want and you'll get the vibes.
Right That part. But, you know, it is sad because whiteness is a made up construct that is it forces people into a criminal enterprise and forces them to defend it. Right. If you want to be a part of it. And that's a hell of a thing for the majority of people in this country to have to align themselves with the Trail of Tears and enslavement and all. Like, why should they have to fly a Confederate flag? When you look at a Trump rally and you see a Confederate flag, like, you fought the, you what, 90% of the people out there that lost their lives during the Civil War fighting for enslavement didn't own anybody. So they're fighting. So you're telling me you and your people fighting to want to own somebody? Like, is this who you are? Like, at some point, there's got to be a reckoning on this narrative, and you're fighting to preserve your whiteness when DNA-wise, ask the South Africans.
Yes.
There's a Skin, I talk about this movie, Skin. Sophie Okonedo plays a girl born into a white family, but she turned out looking like you. Because the DNA, I learned that in biology, 10th grade.
Right.
Recessive versus dominant, which is why this whole notion of an Aryan master race makes no biological sense. And every scientist that's out there talking about it, your DNA will always fight you.
Right.
Silly rabbits.
Might as well be talking about phrenology or whatever. But it's so interesting because... It what I mean is the limits of her imagination, because her mind is trapped in whiteness. So she's like, I can't identify with this. And the reason I pointed out this specific way is because as Black people, all of us understand we've all had to watch stories we weren't part of and we identified. Every single one of us. We watched a story that didn't have a place where they put Black people in it. And we walked out of there and we still found ourselves. What?
Hold on, Rod. I got to get off. I just got a DM. I'm sorry. Let's go to line 7. No. Come on through, Cornbread. Cornbread, Omar Miller in Los Angeles is on the line. You better stop playing with me, sir.
What's happening?
What's up? Hello.
You know.
I may never be a filmmaker, but he inspires me to be even better at the thing.
How are things?
Listen, I'm sorry you got like that, but you went too far to the bathroom. Why you ain't just go around to the... How you go all the way?
There was no answer. If you go outside the juke, they got you either way it goes.
Yeah, well, that's true. But then you ain't had to come back and get the people like that. Talk about, can we just all get along? I said, man, why are you trying to get the people got...
How many takes did they give
people.
You?
That's why.
How many takes did they give you? Did you improv any of that, like getting back in stuff? Because that seemed real fun.
It was a lot of fun, and it was, and I improvised a lot of it. But Ryan's writing is so solid that he had the essence of what we were trying to do. So I just stayed within that with the improv. But if you look at it from a symbolic and a metaphoric standpoint, Delroy, I did a lot of my presses go around with Delroy Lindo, the fabulous Thespian. And he described the film in this great way, is that it's a film about a vibrant community that gets infiltrated by outsiders and then turns on itself. And you see what it is. And like my character is a catalyst, because once he comes back and he's trying to get in, from that point forward, you're on full speed roller coaster.
Yes,
I mean, it really picks up from that point. You see it from the metaphoric standpoint. The character is trying to get back in to do to his own people what has been done to him, which is so deep.
Omar, can you listen? First of all, how'd you end up here? You driving around? And you just said I'm gonna call in to the camera at the show. What did somebody tell you got to call in? What happened?
No, not at all. I listen to your show all the time. I've been listening to your show for a long time.
Omar Miller's listening. This is so. I'm so humbled right now. First of all, I fell in love with you on Ballers, right? Ballers.
Mm-hmm.
You were my dude. Okay.
Thank you.
And to see you in this role, I mean, I just absolutely love. Your humanity, it just shows, it comes through in everything that you do. And even this, I didn't want Cornbread to get got like that. Your
me
wife
neither,
right
man.
Now, I said, oh, no.
Why I had to be a... Cornbread?
Not Cornbread. Then you. Oh, my goodness. All right, so I'm going to need you to hold on, because I have a 11 billion questions for you. So Rod and I are just here giving out tickets, you know, to sinners and chopping it up with the people. And then on line 7, there's a guy named Omar and Cali. And then the screener said, it's Omar from Sinners, Cornbread. I was like, no way. And it's him. So
crazy.
Omar's sticking around. Omar Benson Miller. Shout out to his brother, Terry, who's also listening. How did you get the role? And how many people did you have to audition? And were you up against a bunch of folk for this role? Because it's pivotal.
It's pivotal. And you know what's funny is that I actually met Coogler years ago, probably like 15, 16 years ago, at the Miracle of St. Anna. I was getting an award, a Rising Star Award, at the Pan-African Film Festival, and he was still in college. And he was interning at the award show, and he came up to me afterwards. I was with my brother, with my mom, with my family, and he said, man, I love your stuff. I'm going to work with you one day. And as I'm apt to do, I was like, yeah, brother, I'll see you there. And little did I know, he was about to turn into Ryan Coogler. And, you know, he turned it up between Fruitvale and Creed and Panther, and I got a call that he wanted to meet up, and so I said okay, and I walked in. He sent some materials. Everything was super high classified, you know, they kept it all under wraps. So he sent some material, and I came in, and the first thing he did was apologize that I didn't have any audition. And I was like, man, this dude is as humble as they come. That's part of the job. You know, I have, sometimes I audition, sometimes I don't. That's, you know, it is what it is. That's how the game works. But I'm capable of auditioning. And so we had the audition process in the room. He was like, oh yeah, it's exactly how I knew it was going to be. Which, you know, kind of indicated to me that there was maybe somebody else who had questions about whether or not I was the right person. And next thing I know, about 2-3 weeks later, I was on a plane to New Orleans to make the film. And man, oh man, has he become a part of my life, man. That brother, to use the vernacular, protect Ryan Coogler at all costs. He's a very righteous, solid young man.
Yes.
Are you going to finesse your way into Black Panther 3?
That's up to him. Like, they don't finesse him. I'm not even trying to be shy. If Ryan calls, then we on set. Count on him.
You should like, was you trying to like sneak in an African accent on set just to show him like you could do it?
The Black Panther is street.
Where is the craft services table?
I don't know. The power of the Blick is, you know, that's my man. That's my man, Forrest Whitaker. That's already there. And everybody always getting us confused anyway. So I try to tread lightly.
He could be
you can play his son.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Black Panther 3.
We got a role. Okay.
Y'all done already cast the movie.
Omar Benson Miller, when did you know? Because I'll be honest. When I saw the trailer, I was like, I'll wait for the streamers. Because, I got 50 all of the streamers. I ain't going to the theater. People breathing on me to see no damn vampire movie. I love Ryan Coogler, but then I don't know what it was that made me like actually go get a ticket, sit in the theater, because I don't really do that. When did you know this was going to be special? Because I think a lot of us didn't know until we sat there. When did you know?
Well, no, I knew when as soon as we started filming, because you know what? Ryan creates such a special atmosphere. The dude has an athletic background and he's like a great coach. Everything is respectful, familial. I've never been on a more egalitarian set in my life. The young man knows everybody by name. It's 200 people on set. He knows every single person by name. And, you know, he produces with his wife. He has his lifelong friends that he produces his films with. His mama came to set. I was like, okay, this dude's on to something. And then when we started to shoot and I would see the stuff that Autumn was doing, and he and I actually spoke about what the history, how he came up with this script. And we found out that we shared a bond because his family was from Mississippi and migrated to Northern California, whereas my family was from Mississippi and were sharecroppers and migrated to Southern California. And so we got on really well. And then about a quarter of the way through the production, one day we were at work and Mike came up to me. He was like, hey, man, you got to come to the monitor. My knees were screaming. My feet were screaming. I was like, man, I'm cool because I don't really like to watch myself while we're filming. He's like, no, come now. All right, man. So we go over there and we watch some footage. And Mike looked at me and he said, hey, I think we got one. I know Mike for like 20 years. We just never worked together. And it was around that time that I started to see the stuff that we were doing and how his vision was coming to life from the page to the screen to what we were filming. And I was like, oh, man, this is going to be something special. Then when he called me and he showed it to me, myself, Miles Caton that plays Preacher Boy, Jack O'Connell that plays Rennick, and Delroy Lindo, we all sat together and watched the film. And I mean, it's the first time that I've had a film that I'm in that lands on me as if I'm not in it, like I'm in the audience. The film is beautiful. You can't tell me nothing about this one. I mean, I absolutely love this film.
Besides the scene that everybody's talking about in the juke joint and the chain gang, which I heard that was complete ad lib by Delroy Lindo, like it wasn't scripted that way. What scene for you stood out like for the ages besides those two?
In all honesty, the Irish jig. The Rocky Road to Dublin scene is so key. It's such a key turning point in the story. And, you know, I heard you guys speaking before and you're spot on. All this stuff was well thought out. Ryan made sure that the vampire was Irish because the Irish people were enslaved like we were enslaved. So there's another dastardly level to the vampire that then in turn actually is luring other people through some sympathy and some empathy to the dark side. And you can go on for hours about that from a symbolic and from a metaphorical place. But we were out there that night. We had a hard time shooting this film because the Juke is actually set on a bayou and there's a swamp. Alligators walked on set. There was chiggers in the ground. It was 100 degrees at night. This film was hard to make, really hard to make. And meanwhile, at that point, I'm there in the circle and the sun is about to come up. And we had to chase the sun to make sure that we got the shots. So Jack had to be on his game. You're watching Mike at this point playing Stack, and he's completely focused on the new joy that he has from his false path and happiness of his eternal life that he's been given from the devil, if you will. And to see everybody at the top of their game, because we didn't have a lot of time. There wasn't a lot of takes. And to watch everybody at the top of their game and to see what that meant as a transition in the film, because they're connected through the music. You know, this is why Sammy is so appealing to him. It's his natural God-given talent, the music. And you can see Remick, the vampire, is totally and completely offended when we tell him he can't come in the Juke because of his skin color. He can't believe that. He's devastated because he really does believe in the music. And he really does believe in the power of the music, you know. And it's really interesting because shortly after that, this is when he goes into a shot at colonization. There's so much in the film to cover. I mean, don't even get me started because we could do a symposium on all of the different stuff in the films.
Speaking back
to that piece. Let me get this. I'm sorry to cut you off quick. Speaking back about that piece about you guys, how you had the pastor on. You know, when I first read the script and he was basically doing the baptism of Sammy and he drops into lockstep with him on the Lord's Prayer, that's when I read the script and I was like, okay, I need to see where this is going to go because I might not be able to do this from a personal belief standpoint. And then one of the things that I think connects with people and makes them see the film multiple times is what he says. And when he goes into the Lord's Prayer, Remick says something so powerful. He said, these were the words forced upon me by the men who stole my land and killed my people. And I hated those men, but I still find comfort and truth in their words. Mm. So it is speaking deeply about religion, about colonization, about the word of God itself. It's well worth your time if anybody's on the fence. I think the biggest thing to know is that this is not a vampire movie. There's a movie with vampires in it, but this is not a vampire movie by any means.
Yeah, I agree. What's next, man? What you got cooking on next? Or are you tired of people asking that question already?
Oh, you never get tired of that. I mean, I'm of the mind that it's always better, never best. So I'm on to the next. I made a wonderful film in Italy that I'm waiting to find out when it comes out stateside because I would love people to see it. It's another actual period piece called Napoli to New York, and it did gangbusters numbers at the box office in Italy at the end of last year, but they've yet to release it yet stateside. And it, too, is a period piece that is strangely modern. And one of the things that Kugler did so expertly is we're in the 1930s, so the majority of the film was in the 1930s, Mississippi, but the film is in lockstep with relevance for today, with everything that we're dealing with today. And when I say we, I don't even just mean we as the culture, we as black people. I mean Americans and the world.
Yeah, I mean, but
because
that's
we're in a very, very dark time.
That's how the spirit works and the ancestors work.
Amen.
I mean, when we're in alignment with it, it all becomes revelatory, and you do things today, not for today, because you're throwing yourself into the future, but you're also there's so much going on. All right.
Experience Karen Hunter in a completely different way. Karen Hunter is awesome. The podcast.
If you like me on SiriusXM Urban View Channel 126, you're going to love me.
And Karen Hunter is awesome.
Hey, this is Karen Hunter, host of the Karen Hunter Show on SiriusXM's Urban View. Karen Hunter is Awesome is an actual podcast to bring heat and energy and knowledge and power. A 1-2 punch that I don't think you get anyplace else.
Tell the truth.
So check out the podcast wherever you get your podcast. You will not be disappointed.
All right, now let's hear from Native Land Podcasters.
What's up, everybody? It's been a minute, y'all. It's Andrew Gillum here, reintroducing myself through this mini pod. I hope everybody had a good weekend. If you're listening on Monday here live, and I know mine was eventful. That is for sure. So first point, a personal privilege. I want to wish again a very, very special and happy birthday to my life partner, my wife, my everything, my best friend, RJ Gillum, who turned blah, 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 yesterday, Sunday. And my son and the kids wrote their own cards out. I won't say her real age. I'll let her say it. But my oldest, Jackson, writes a beautiful note. And then at the end says, "Happy 57th birthday, Mommy." And neither of those, actually only one of those digits is in her age. It ain't the five. Okay, that's it. continuing, one more update. My kid, my youngest, Davis, breaks his damn arm in two places and does it at school. And the most wildest thing, you know, I've seen. And what is great is the kid's threshold for pain is crazy good. Because shortly after I arrived to collect him and his siblings to go to the hospital, he starts comforting them. "It's going to be okay, Caroline. It's going to be okay, Jackson." I thought, Davis, man, you are a soldier, because I'd be screaming bloody murder, which he was when we got there. But everybody's doing well. And I hope the same is true on your end. I am not going to take up a terribly long amount of time. I wanted to continue this conversation about resistance and organizing in the political environment that we all find ourselves, and really doubling down on this idea of doing it right where you are, in your own local community. And by the way, protests or opposition doesn't always have to come in the form of taking over a building or even lining the streets with people. A form of protest could be running for your local school board, your local city council, your county council, places and institutions locally who people often underestimate for their impact. But if you were to really analyze what probably impacts your everyday lived experience, the road you drive on, the power, you know, that you drive, you know, pull on for your electric supply, the schools that your kids attend, and quite frankly, the type of businesses that surround where you live and maybe where you go to church, the kind of infrastructure that either does exist or doesn't, say, for instance, internet or high-speed internet or fiber being available to you, and who are the people who provide that, and then who are the people who govern the rules that allow them to do what they do if the local government itself isn't the entity that does it. And whether you're organizing an effort for a cause, for people, or running for or supporting someone running for office, there's very, 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 very little you can do without resources. Those resources can come in the form of time, which a lot of times is exactly what you use the raised financial resources to do, pay somebody to provide a service to do a thing. And if you were able to have someone's time, in the right someone's time, they would be doing that work. And so by resources, I'm being a little bit elastic in that definition, but very specifically, now I wanted to just chat with y'all about what it means to do direct fundraising, to ask someone to support what it is you're doing or to support you directly. And I will not lie, fundraising was and has been for a long time like the bane of my existence when I had to do it pretty regularly. I really, really, really hated people. Calling folks to ask for money. And I think it has something to do with just maybe my childhood and how I grew up, very proud family, you know, maybe poor by objective standards, but, and my parents, you know, in their mind's eye, and they communicated the same to us, is that, you know, we were rich in love, we were rich in family, we were rich in spirit, and you know, I was just hoping we'd be rich in money, but whatever. They didn't raise us with a beggar's attitude, if you will. And I've associated asking people for things, money specifically, but even other things, as sort of breaking that cardinal rule that I think was instilled in me early. And so I had to walk myself back off the fact that it is not a burden that you're giving someone when you ask them to sow a seed into what you believe in or even into you directly. Say, for instance, you were a candidate and you needed to raise money, but rather it is a sign of respect and humility to to be willing to go to someone and to respect them enough to say, I want you and I need you with me in order for this thing to be possible. People love to be asked. And that's exactly what a lot of candidates don't like to do the asking. And some people are in love with it. Y'all, you know, listen, you may be in love with it. You may like the idea and the challenge. I would much prefer to call and check up and see how you're doing than call and ask for money. But to an extent, I got over it. I had to get over it. My race for governor, we raised, you know, over $60 million through various outlets and arms, wherein I had to make, significant asks all along the way. In fact, in the primary process, and those of you around campaigns might be able to relate, I would go entire days, 7-8 hours of call time on the phone, calling folks. And some folks, you know, being willing to engage me in rather extended conversation. And to a person, at the end of that day, every answer, and I'm not giving folks credit for their excuses, but for every question of around the money I wanted to raise, the answer was no from every single person to a person. And that was really challenging. And these were largely not people who I knew personally, or if I knew, didn't know very well personally. But these were people whose names were on a call list, a call sheet that was provided to me, who had the characteristics through their previous giving of looking like I would be the type of person they might give to if asked. There was a lot in that by way of what I wanted to communicate, because a lot of folks are, I think, confused about how the process works around trying to raise money. One big, I think, you know, misnomer about it, and I think this is on the candidate side more than it is the organizational or the cause side of things, and that is that that people, how do you say, are sort of just sort of, that it's the scariest thing in the world that you could possibly do is to pick up the phone and call a person whom you don't know and ask them for money. But the truth is over time, a profile gets built on those individuals. If you have a finance staff person, they'll make you aware that, hey, John Doe looks like he gives the Sierra Club and also a big supporter of criminal justice reform because he gives to, you know, whatever democracy project that might be out there. You may not know them, but by reading a little bit about them and their interests kind of gives you a little bit of the courage necessary to pick up the phone and say, hey, John, you've been a, you know, a supporter of such and such and such, and my position on the environment it aligns with what I understand yours to be. And, you know, if you give me this amount, you know, we'll be able to do great things and build a beautiful future, prioritizing the things that both you and I care a great deal about. Those individuals are not unaccustomed to getting phone calls, to being asked for money. If you're nervous or a little bit uneasy about that process, please satisfy yourself by knowing that these people are used to this. And right now, at this stage, expect that if they're going to give money politically to this cause or to this individual candidate, that person or someone from that institution or that effort is going to reach out to them directly and ask them for money. And frankly, would take it as an insult if the ask came through somebody else. The other thing about asking that was really important for me to learn and to understand and to really receive was this notion of respect, that it's respectful to ask someone for their money. I'm not sure respect is what I would have initially associated with it, but in truth, data from fundraising outlets and experts does show that people want to be asked. They want to be asked by the candidate or the person leading the cause or high up in it, and largely don't give significant money, may give $25-$50 here, but are not going to give significant dollars unless they're asked. It's important to know that because it should assuage us a little bit of some of the concern there. But it's really important to be able to raise these resources to get across the finish line on whatever the mission is. People can't work forever for free. There are a lot of folks who want to be in movement-based work, and they're looking for a job full-time. I think as progressives who go around advocating for a higher minimum wage and for health care for all and for the ability for people to work to earn a respectable living for themselves, we can advocate all those things. But then when it comes to asking for us, a candidate, or asking for an organization, we get real shy and we sort of forget about what it means to pay these individuals for their time, energy, effort, when the resources are allocated, and you got the resources to do that. And so let's just release the burden of shame with fundraising. And I'm still pulling back the layers of mine, but having raised for an organization before in my professional life and for causes, and also raising significant money as a candidate, I will tell you, I always found it easier to raise for a cause, for a purpose, for an organization, at least easier for me making the ask. But in fact, in politics, you're dealing many times with people who are used to being asked and are used to giving. And it's sort of, if you allow yourself, you make a game of the process of the asks and how many ways you might ask in a single call to help that person get to yes. Another misnomer is that people on the other end of the phone, on the other end of your ask, feel like friends. Don't feel like good friends and real friends would be the sort of same individual who would then turn around and ask you for money. I never stumbled on that, but there were a lot of people who were basically like, if I have an authentic, and maybe friends isn't the right word I should use, people with whom they've worked with, have worked for, or they know through some other association and not really a very familiar one, they believe that it might present as unsincere or insincere a relationship, and that the person being asked might conclude that, oh, you're only my friend, or you're only trying to cozy up to me to ask me for my resources, to take something from me. In truth, you're an authentic person, you're a real person, you're real wherever you are, I hope. And the same passion you would put into asking for yourself, you would put into asking for a cause. And that's probably the same passion that landed you in relation to this person in the first place. So people are more complex than that, and they also get it. So we've got to let ourselves off the hook. One common mistake that I find when fundraising, especially if you're one of these people who has an ethos or grown up with a habit around not asking and having shame around asking, you talk yourself and you talk the person who you're asking to give out of the gift. I'll give you an example. Jody, it's been a minute, but I hope you're doing well. Oh, I'm doing well. Yeah, great. I'm not going to do both voices. I'll just do mine. You can assume, plug in what you want. Y'all know how I humor myself, and I'm like humoring myself right now. But Jody, hey, I just wanted to reach out and let you know that I've decided I'm gonna run for the local school board and do everything that I can. Jody's probably screaming at this point on the other end while you're still talking. And I would love for you to be one of my early donors to show, you know, your support. Now, Jody, if she's a homegirl, she's probably already screaming and is like, what can I do? All this kind of stuff. But if she's less of that, she's saying, yeah, well, of course. And then you make the amount ask, or maybe you don't mention a number and you just say, I know times are tough and I know the kids are getting ready to go back to school, or I know summer's coming up and you're going to be paying a lot for those camps. So, you know, you got a lot to think about, but I would really love if you would do this for me. Well, you've already started negotiating against yourself with Jody, telling her all the things she ain't even thinking about right now that may be expense coming up, and giving her all kinds of reasons to either one, not give, or two, to give, which is probably more likely she would, but to give a lesser amount, because all the things you just reminded her are upcoming expenses that she wasn't even thinking about. People know their wallets generally, and they have a general understanding of the capacity that they can give at. A person who knows their financial situation enough is and knows that the most they can give is 50, but you're the friend they ain't gonna spring for 500. they're probably delusional because, you know, you got other things you got to do. But generally, a $500 person is not in the same bracket generally with the person who's only got the capacity to give, you know, $25 and may spring for 50. But they're not going to go from 25 to 500 generally. But you talk yourself out of the ask. And one of the habits that I sort of observed, and I've now heard later taught, I wish I had been taught it before I observed it for myself, having run, you know, when I was 23 years old and talked a lot of people out of giving, if not giving generally, certainly giving what they could if they were really stretching themselves. But that habit, that tool was to make the ask, and not just we need you to give money or we want you to give money, but more specific than that, I would love for you to invest in me and in this race and in the future of our state by giving $100 to this effort, you know, in time for our next reporting period at the end of the month, or 500 or 1,000. A lot of times early on, and if you aren't well trained in the art of asking for the gift, you're going to negotiate yourself out of the gift if you keep talking. And so developing a habit of something to do as a distraction from having to keep talking. Silence can be uncomfortable, especially after you didn't ask some people for $8. They're hard-earned money. But you have to force yourself to stop. So to role play this real quick, it would be, you know, and I would really, really appreciate you making a $500 contribution to help us change our state or change our community and make our schools better for our kids. I know you feel like I do about how desperately things need to change. This is a way that we can really do something about it. And if you could make that contribution, firstly, I would be eternally grateful. But secondly, in time for us to report that gift and our next fundraising report, which would be an impressive display for people to see and to know that you're giving, one, but two, that we're also raising real resources here to make this thing happen. And then stop and take a drink of water. Don't ever go to a fundraising meeting without a bottle of something or a container of something that you can drink, hopefully non-alcoholic, something you can drink as a way of shutting yourself up. And if you don't figure out practice, I mean that, what method you're going to instrument to keep yourself from talking, I would suggest something non-distracting, not like, oh, do-do-do-do-do-do-do. That's not, you know, you don't do that thing. But maybe a different habit that you might develop. But my habit was taking a drink. So I'd make that ask. I'd say the amount, and I'd say when I'd like to get it. And I appreciate you listening to my vision. Put it down. And by that time, they've already taken up the task of responding. It's either a quick one, yes, I can do that, or no, I can't. But generally, people want to get to yes. And sometimes it's your job to help them get there. So two different potential outcomes aside from the yes scenario might be, I wish I could, but I am, I've decided, I think I may stay out of this race. You know, I know a lot of you all in it, da 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 da. And you say, you know, Jim, I understand that. I know you got a lot of friends throughout this race. And I certainly don't want to put you in a position where you're put out by them. And if you cannot find yourself in the course of the race that we're in to invest in me as a candidate, do I understand you're also not going to invest in anybody else? Oh, yeah, if I'm staying out, I'm staying out. I'm not going to. Okay. Have you considered, or maybe perhaps would you consider what it would mean to maybe make an investment in all of us as a show of support that, you know, hey, you know, you're my friend enough that I will stay out of giving to anyone else in this race. I want to put some money behind you, and I'm going to do the same for a couple of other people, right? So just creating off-ramps. Another off-ramp might be, okay, I understand that $500 is a lot of money. I know. God knows I work hard for every dime that I earn. I'm wondering, do you think it might be possible to do 100 or potentially commit to 100 and over a period of cycles pay a little bit toward that commitment? give them the opportunity to respond to that. People don't like silence for a lot of folks, unless you know somebody real well. A lot of folks generally don't vibe well with quiet. We always fill the moment. Use fundraising as an opportunity to not fill the moment with your voice. Your presence ought to be there, but with silence to give the other person the cue that it's not time for them to respond to you. So one way, again, might be, I can't meet that amount as a form of rejection. The form of rejection in this case is, I've got a bunch of people I know, and so the off-ramp you gave is, can you give to all of us? Another potential scenario might be that the amount is too high. We work through that as part of this scenario with the friends. And in that case, again, you can do this sort of step-down, step-off approach. Sometimes the opportunity presents itself as a chance to make your case and to make it very directly and strongly for why a person ought to be behind you or be with you or give to you. And that's the instance where the potential donor says, you know, I'm still sort of taking my time and I'm waiting to see what's going to happen there. I'll get involved at some point, but, you know, right now we're just sort of observing the field. Again, with the spirit of never, ever taking no, or the response that you don't want as the ultimate response, convince yourself that there is always a way to yes. There is always a way to yes. It's just our jobs as those who are going out to try to raise these resources for a cause or for a candidate to be creative enough and confident enough in ourselves, and moreover, confident enough in the work that we are raising for. If it's a mission, you know, have that thing in your spirit, in your soul. It'll power you through a day of 7 hours of phone calls, and every answer is no, right? As the example I gave. But you ought to feel strongly enough about the thing you're raising for that you'll be willing to go the extra step of being creative to help facilitate somebody getting to the answer yes. I want to invite Lolo in, our sister Lolo. Lolo, I'd love to, if you're able to join, I'd love if you're able to monitor whether there are any questions or anything like that, or if in the course of listening here, I'm assuming you was listening, in the course of listening here, that maybe there's some angles here that I didn't go down that you think in the few moments we have remaining are worthwhile to do. What's up, Lolo?
Hi, y'all. We actually have some really good questions. We got a few. So I'm gonna start off with the first one, and it is, how do you create a leaderless organization? I think that this is not very specific. We do have some that are specific to the fundraising aspect, but I've seen this one. It was one of the first ones, and it was like, how do you create a leaderless organization? Also one that is completely transparent.
Oh, what did you say before being completely transparent?
Also, it's just also one that is completely transparent.
Right, that it is without a leader, and that your intention is not to listen. This is actually a really layered and complex question. When you get at it, we've been having in Native Land Pod a bit of a conversation around who is our leader, you know, in circumstances. Who are we following? I don't feel like there's anybody, you know, that kind of thing. And I sort of like to introduce into the conversation that there are a lot of models of organizations, and even of governing bodies that operate without a known leader, a singular known leader, I should say. Leadership exists, but a singular known leader. And I'm actually an advocate for that. I think we've gotten a little bit too Western in our styles, that we think we need a person, Donald Trump, a cult of personality to follow. We don't. And part of the way through that is, one, to believe, is to get a sense of if everybody agrees that we need to be leaderless and rather accountable. That is an important decision that must be bought into by the people who are engaged and involved. Once you get beyond the buy-in, you could create a panel of individuals. You can create rotating leadership that is not by volunteerism, but by lot, which is, if you're involved in this, just know one day, when we roll the dice, you may be the one who's up here leading. And that, again, requires a lot of trust that people have the skill sets to do what is required. But there are a lot of models to do that. And I can't get through all of them, but I wanted to at least share one example there. Sorry about that. Go ahead, Lowell.
No, that was good. I was surprised that was your answer.
Oh, really? You thought that? I'm actually. I think people are fallible. We're imperfect, and a lot of times this sort of cult of an individual's personality weds us to a lot of things that if we had our druthers, our choices, we wouldn't be wed, you know, to those things. And or it is when that person disappoints us, the movement starts to come apart because they've made him priest and pope and not person, or they've made her priest and pope and not person. They're persons. And if everybody understands that and is willing to ride like that, then cool. But in other instances, it might be helpful for people to be wedded to the cause, wedded to the thing that you're on and not to the to an individual.
Yeah. One of the other questions that we had is, how would you recommend building a donor list? Actually a question I had about that too.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't get into list building and that kind of thing. And especially with individual candidates, but also organizationally, where does the information come from? Especially if you've never raised money before, right? So here it is. This is the era of big information, big technology, big government, big everything. You can now purchase these lists from organizations. You can purchase them from companies. These are ready-made lists that exist in the broader fundraising spectrum, where people collect data on everybody who's given to environmental organization X, the Sierra Club. You can see everybody who's given to NAACP based off of tax filings and that sort of thing. But the information gets cold for you. And all you got to do is go through and you say, oh, man, if they gave to Jesse Jackson Jr., they might be the kind of donor who would be interested in giving to me. If they gave to Kamala Harris out in California, and also to Cory Booker, and also to Reverend Warnock, it seems to me this might be the type of person who likes to give to individuals who are people of color who are not usually elected to these large bodies of government, and that makes a good donor. But your fundraising person, or you, if you're the person and you don't have that, can of course search where you can purchase these lists and make that decision. I will tell you, in the race for governor, initially that thing began with whoever I had in my cell phone or an email I had an address for, but the friends and family network was the first ask that I made, and it is the most important ask you can make, and one that will largely power you up until the point that you've got to broaden out and expand the amount of money that you're raising. But those lists exist, they can be bought, and you can then, across a set of criteria, determine who are the best fits for you, and either make those phone calls, send those emails, or put them on your mail program where they would give the money themselves directly.
Okay, Andrew, I'm going to ask one more question. I know we had more, but I think some of your answers is kind of like answering some of the other ones.
Got it.
So, someone
in telling me I'm talking too much. I love it.
So no, it's not. This is actually really good information. So Kaya says, how do you assuage people's new fear of retaliation? So she said, I'm finding that during phone banking and VA lately, that people are becoming more hesitant to even reveal their political views over the phone.
Oh, so true. Or period, where that information can then be tracked back to them, right? And this is the real chilling effect and lasting effect of what Trump is demonstrating at the federal level, that if you cross me, Harvard University, I'm taking all 50 million away. If individual X decides to sue me, I'm going after your sister, your brother, your cousin and them, and all of them are going to have problems with ICE, right? And bless the court that can force me to bring them back right after I've sent them away. So there is this real legitimate fear, because it's not just at the federal level. Conservatives and Trumpers all around the country are taking note, and in places where they have the ability, they're trying to extract the exact same kind of penalties that he's illustrating at the federal level that you can do and get away with. So I would say, one, it's really hard to completely cover the fears of someone who is afraid of being doxxed or being come after if they give. I'm guessing if you're calling from a list of either people you know or people who you don't know but have demonstrated record of giving before, they will already have an appetite to push through because they would be more accustomed to it anyway. Not knowing your specific situation, your proximity to Washington, D.C., being in Virginia, probably makes this more pronounced for you, given the number of employees who are federal workers and also reside in Virginia. So I want to acknowledge the adjacency issue that you got and why that feels more pronounced for you than not. Generally, I think people will get over that fear with a little bit of, you realize that, you know, they're probably not looking at this list at our level, or they're, you know, this is that and the third. And obviously I would never ask you to do anything that will put you personally in harm's way. And if you feel strongly enough that showing your support for me in this race could make you available to personal attack from the government or retribution, I don't want to put you in that position. That's your first answer, is you don't want to go there. People, my guess is the majority will say, you know, it was put well. I'm not afraid enough of you and giving to you that people are going to come after me. I think I can get over that. Yeah, I'll give. I think the majority of respondents are probably going to be that way than they would, yeah, it's just too rough right now, little person that I am, that everybody's tracking me, right? But in some places, it's really real and retribution is real. They're going to do what they're going to do. I would make the effort to first say what you really mean, which is your intention is not to get anybody in trouble. And if that causes that big a concern for you, I'm not going to ask you to give to me. But in most cases, I think they will. If it persists as an issue and this is a big enough donor, you also have the option of directing them to give to an organization that is in support of you, or to a organization or an arm of a fundraising organization that you may have access to where their information is protected. And for those of y'all who are screaming right now, I know I am talking about 527s and those kinds of political organizations that conceal the giving of their donors. It is a weapon that the other side uses, and I'm just not a big fan of unilaterally disarming and allowing folks to come at me with everything they have with my hands tied behind my back. It's not an option.
Mm-hmm. Well, Andrew, this is really good. It's up to you, because I know Nick is probably like, y'all are over time.
I know we got a wrap.
But there was like one question please. That we just got, and I thought it was a really good question.
Oh, please.
Okay, well, Nick says we good. So we're going to do one more question. How do you counsel yourself to not take the no's personally, especially if it comes from personal contacts, not typical donors?
So tough. It is. It's a head fake. I'm going to admit that straight up. I live in a government town, and so a lot of people who I know personally and have personal relationships with me, with Jay, with our family, work either in the government or adjacent to it, or our friends with people who are political. And so I'm accustomed to the kind of response of, you know, oh, I wish I could, but I, you know, so on and so forth. The way I sort of mind trick myself is to basically remind myself it ain't personal for those individuals. It is personal for me. I wouldn't put myself out there if I didn't feel, you know, if I didn't feel it. But I realize that everyone does not have the freedom. I want to underline that word, freedom, to move the way they want to move, that if they had their druthers, they would move. Everybody's not free. In fact, the overwhelming majority of us are not free. We're tethered to something that causes us to have to question a thing when the going gets tough. And so know that they're not trying to put you off, but are frankly, they're tending to their home needs, their personal needs first. And I don't think any of us could reasonably expect people not to. Now, I will also say that there are some folks who are maybe not friends, wouldn't do this to you, but are associates who might reach for that excuse, even when that excuse, frankly, doesn't apply very neatly to their situation. And if you know that, you can go the approach of navigating another set of asks that can get them to yes. A lower ask, a different amount, a different way or instrument, or whether or not you want to trade that ask amount for time or talent. Those folks, I would probably say create another option for them to be supportive. But people who you legit believe are conflicted right that way, don't take it personal. It happens. And you just got to keep moving. God knows those days that were 7 hours long, and I couldn't, no matter how good the conversation went, how many times they agreed with me, and by agreeing with me was basically disagreeing with the person who they were going to be giving to or had given to, because that person didn't believe like I did. Those are really difficult days. Those are difficult calls, and those are difficult moments. But if I allowed myself to be tripped up on it, I would have been, you know, half the amount effective in future calls. Because the thing about these calls is your confidence needs to be intact. Whether that is the confidence around the movement you're raising for, or confidence around yourself as a candidate, or on behalf of the candidate. Your confidence is what's going to power you through that call. And your confidence is what's going to give you all those options that come to mind as another way for the person to contribute or to give. But if you're down, you might hear that no, and you'll be like, I understand. I really appreciate you taking my call and taking up 30 minutes of my time agreeing and then not giving. I really do. I'm being facetious.
I was about to say. But the way you say it is so, like, I'm taking notes, like, I'm going to do this next time.
Oh, God. All 30 minutes, because we could have covered this at moment one. You knew I was calling
you
the money.
You literally could have told me that 30 seconds in. Like, you know what? I'm going to stop you there.
Oh, look, before you go on, I just want to say, I'm behind such and such in this race. As we can get through that. But 30 minutes? Anyway.
You know what's so funny, Andrew, real quick while we're ending this. A lot of people don't know this, but in my previous life, I had started an organization. It's actually still around. Been around for about 6 years now, and I had to do fundraising in the organization. And so a lot of the stuff that you're talking about, I'm like, oh, I remember those days.
Oh, I'm telling you. It's
a
trip.
Or you go to someone's event, or, you know, just all of the things that you have to do. But you can't take this stuff personal.
No.
Somebody told me that people who know you personally usually are sometimes the last people to come around.
Sometimes. Now, that's going to be another conversation than the general donors we're talking about. But we're going to have a conversation, those longtime friends, associates, family members. I definitely got some messed up cousins. Still waiting for that check, by the way. Anyway, but who, you know, folks who, as the saying goes, I'll say this, Lolo. The saying is, it's hard to be a prophet in your own land, which is, you're preaching the same thing at home that you're out there preaching on the road. But it seems like the people on the road can hear what you're saying, you know, and credit you for the gift you got. But at home, you just a little, you know, you're just another, you know, whatever. So it's hard to be a prophet in your own land. And fundraising can be that way sometimes. People are slow to give until they see that others are willing to do the same without relationship to you.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I just want to say this because we actually are starting to get more questions in. Like, people are really interested in this topic, but we're not going to.
Well, you know, a phase two possibly might be how we deal more specifically in the organizational side. Some of the technocratic kinds of things that go into getting yourself ready for fundraising, because there are some things that I just really skipped over. Out of the interest of trying to be brief here, but fundraising is something you must master if you're going to be in this space for yourself as a candidate or for a cause. You want to master that.
So what I will say for the immediate people who are watching this, if you all have a specific question and you want to continue this conversation, I'm going to give you a soft plug. If you are not following us on Instagram, go to our Instagram at NativeLandPod. And if you record a quick, 60-second video, it could be less than that. Try not to make it more than 90 seconds. And send it to us in our DMs. We like to include those questions on the regular show.
Yeah.
So this could be a conversation for the regular show. I see that there were some questions. I'm like, oh, that was really good. Like, Neek asked a question. Please submit that question to us on our Instagram. Do you have some parting words, Andrew?
Do y'all see what Lolo just did? Y'all just got co-opted. She's not taking no for an answer. This is just because we can't do it now. There are other ways in which you can do it, but she tried to co-opt you into a video for the main show that we record each week. But please do that. But also, if you want to communicate those questions in this chat, we'll capture them. And in the future episodes, maybe what we'll do is just start at the questions. And if there's time remaining, then make a pitch on one of the points around organizing and raising.
Love it.
And my sign off is, you got to go where the money reside. Where the money reside, where the money reside. Give me that money, that dodo.
All right, 2 weeks from now, meet us next, not the next Monday, but the Monday after that.
That's it. That's it. See y'all soon. Welcome home, y'all.
Welcome home.
Native Land Pod is a production of iHeartRadio in partnership with Reason Choice Media. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
When it comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for youth.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals into your body.
And nicotine, which can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media,
many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping.
Because when you talk, they hear you.
Learn more at underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I believe the big disaster which prevented the occupation from being punished and repeating these crimes is the neglect and indifference by many of the institutions, especially American ones, which continue to defend the occupation.
As the Israeli military kills two more Palestinian journalists in Gaza, a new documentary by Zatteo has uncovered critical details about Israel's killing 3 years ago this week of the acclaimed Palestinian-American Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. The film identifies for the first time the Israeli soldier who allegedly shot Shireen. We'll speak to four guests, including Shireen's brother and niece, as well as the Zatteo founder Mehdi Hassan and the filmmaker Diane Nissenbaum, a former foreign correspondent at the Wall Street Journal. Then to Memphis, where juries acquitted three former Memphis police officers in the 2023 killing of Tyree Nichols, a 29-year-old black father who died after the officers brutally beat him during a traffic stop driving home from work.
Mr. Bean, Mr. Haley, and Mr. Smith, your peers have found you not guilty on all charges with these matters. The court will enter the judgment sheets accordingly. This will conclude your matter that's before the court. Good luck.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip have killed at least 100 people over the past 24 hours as bombs, missiles, and drones struck homes, businesses, apartment buildings, tents housing displaced Palestinians. In one of the latest attacks, Israel bombed a crowded restaurant and marketplace in Gaza City, killing at least 32 people and wounding 86 others. Witnesses said the strike littered the ground with body parts and blood. One survivor fled, clutching a baby, with another two terrified children in tow.
What happened?
While we were at the hall of the restaurant, the Israeli army did a strike and everyone died. The youth died. I can't tell you. Youth at the entrance of the hall, blood was like a lake. Oh my, pools of blood.
Among the dead was Palestinian journalist Yahya Sabaya, who was killed just hours after celebrating the birth of his daughter. Palestinian officials say he's the 214th media worker killed in Gaza since October 2023. Another journalist, Nour al-Din Abdul, was killed in a separate Israeli attack. Israel's unrelenting assault on Gaza came as its total blockade entered its third month. The World Central Kitchen charity said Wednesday it had halted Gaza relief efforts after running out of supplies. Gaza's government media office reports more than 3,500 young children face imminent death from starvation. Another 70,000 children are being hospitalized for severe malnutrition. And 1.1 million Palestinian children lack the minimum nutritional requirements for survival. On Wednesday, more than 20 United Nations experts demanded action by states to avert what they call the annihilation of the Palestinian population. They write, quote, continuing to support Israel materially or politically, especially via arms transfers, risks complicity in genocide and other serious international crimes, unquote. In related news, a new report finds UK firms have continued to export military supplies, including munitions, to Israel, despite the government's suspension of arms export licenses to Israel in September. Meanwhile, Reuters reports Trump officials and their Israeli counterparts have discussed the possibility of the U.S. leading a temporary post-war administration of Gaza. In the occupied West Bank, Israel's continuing its illegal forced displacement of Palestinian communities in the Tulkarem and Nur Shams refugee camp. Last week, Israeli officials announced plans to demolish another 100 Palestinian homes. This is Imam Fathi Haikal, a resident of Nur Shams.
What do they think we are to move us to caravans? This will never happen. Even if they build castles for us, we will not accept. Let them demolish half of the house and give me the other half. I would rather live in a room than in a castle outside a refugee camp. This camp is our life.
Israeli forces also demolished homes and other structures in Masafer Yatta this week. The Israeli military's forcibly displaced tens of thousands of West Bank Palestinians this year. Meanwhile, a new documentary by Zateo has exposed new details about the killing of the Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akla, fatally shot 3 years ago this week in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. For the first time, Zateo has identified Shireen's killer to be an Israeli soldier named Captain Alon Skagio. We'll have more on this story after headlines with an exclusive interview with the founder of Zateo, the filmmaker, and Shireen Abu Akla's brother and niece. India and Pakistan are exchanging heavy artillery fire for a second straight day along the line of control that divides Indian and Pakistan-administered Kashmir. Pakistan's military says Indian airstrikes and shells have killed 31 people and injured 57 others on its side of the Kashmiri border in Pakistan's Punjab province. Among the dead were three people killed when India bombed a mosque in the Kashmiri city of Muzaffarabad. The principal of a nearby school said the attack sparked fear among students.
There has been significant damage here, as you can see. The school was also badly hit. The mosque is in a terrible state, and the mosque's caretaker was martyred. The children are in fear. The school's condition is such that the ceiling has collapsed, the windows are shattered, and the doors and furniture have all been badly damaged.
Meanwhile, India says Pakistani artillery fire has killed at least 13 civilians, including five children. Pakistani Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif promised to retaliate against India in a national address Wednesday, saying, quote, we'll avenge the blood of our innocent martyrs, unquote. In Germany, Friedrich Merz was elected as chancellor Tuesday in a second round of parliamentary voting just hours after he failed to clinch the ballot in the first round, a first in post-war Germany. The new government announced Wednesday Germany will start rejecting undocumented migrants at its border and plans to deploy thousands more police to crack down on arrivals. The move undoes a 2015 order by then-Chancellor Angela Merkel, whose leadership was defined in large part by her welcoming of hundreds of thousands of asylum seekers, many of them who had fled war in Syria. In the United States, a federal judge on Wednesday warned a Trump administration plan to send undocumented immigrants to Libya would violate a court order issued in March. Lawyers for immigrants from Laos, Vietnam, and the Philippines believe a North Africa-bound deportation flight could take off as early as this week. But Libya's two rival governments have denied any such agreement with the U.S., calling the potential move a violation of Libya's sovereignty. Libya has a track record of gross human rights violations in its treatment of refugees and immigrants. The U.N. has reported, quote, widespread practices of arbitrary detention, torture, rape, and slavery. Age